Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine, March 2023 edition. I'm going to conclude the article that we read last week. The article is called Cowboy Up by various authors. Editor's note. At True West Magazine, 70 years since our first issue, we still believe there is no better way to experience the American West than to pack your bags, load up your car, and hit the road. In this 21st edition of our travel issue, we feature getaways written by six seasoned Western writers whose passion for the West and their home states is infectious. We invite you to pull out your maps and dreams and take a road trip to Arizona, Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Montana, South Dakota, Texas, and or Wyoming. We know you will make dreams come true and will start planning your next road trip as soon as you return home. Stuart Rosebrook. Texas. The Lone Star State celebrates the bicentennial of the Texas Rangers. By Mike Cox. Admired by many, denounced by some, the Texas Rangers trace their 200-year history to a 177-word document penned by Texas colonizer Stephen F. Austin on August 5, 1823. In that document, he said he intended to employ 10 men to act as rangers for the common defense. Considered the Ranger Magna Carta, the document was written at Sylvanus Castleman's log cabin, about 5 miles northwest of present LaGrange. Castleman's place served as de facto headquarters for Austin's fledgling colony and was the birthplace of the Rangers. To learn more about Castleman and his land, visit the Fayette County Heritage Museum and Archives, 855 South Jefferson Street in LaGrange. Later in 1823, Austin platted a town site near the Brazos River and named it San Felipe. For 13 years, the village reigned as the capital of his colony and the social, economic, and political hub of Anglo settlement in northern Mexico. As conceived by Austin, paramilitary companies did range his colony in the 1820s, but not until 1835 did the ranging concept become formalized in Texas. That happened at San Felipe, when a body called the Permanent Council met there to grapple with two critical issues, a dictatorial Mexican government and the threat of hostile Indian tribes. Daniel Parker offered a resolution on October 17th proposing a three-company, 70-man standing ranger force. By November, a larger group calling itself a consultation further discussed Parker's idea. On the 24th, the body passed an ordinance establishing a provisional government. Article 9 of an appendage, labeled Of the Military, authorized a corps of rangers. For the first time, the rangers became an arm of the government. San Felipe's chance of continuing as an important Texas city ended during the 1835-36 revolt against Mexico. After the fall of the Alamo in March 1836, when General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, marching in their direction, residents torched the town and fled eastward. The community never regained its pre-war stature, but is one of Texas's most significant historical sites. San Felipe de Austin State Historic Site, 220 2nd Street, San Felipe, features a new museum, interpretive trails, and a bronze statue of Stephen F. Austin. On the Ranger Trail. Up the Brazos from San Felipe is the old town of Washington, better known as Washington on the Brazos. A delegation of Texans gathered there March 1, 1836, to formalize the rebellion against Mexico. The next day, meeting in a drafty frame building, the delegates adopted a Declaration of Independence. Three of the 59 signers were current or former Rangers. A replica of the small structure where that happened is the centerpiece of Washington on the Brazos State Park, 23200 Park Road 12, Washington, Texas. Nearby is the Star of the Republic Museum, a facility devoted to the near decade-long history of the Republic of Texas. In 1833-34, in present Limestone County, the family and followers of Elder John Parker built a split cedar log stockade with two blockhouses and began farming the adjacent land. Their compound, Fort Parker, soon figured in one of the classic dramas of American frontier history. The capture of 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker and her subsequent rescue by Texas Rangers. Much less known is that before that, the fort served as a rendezvous point for the first government-authorized ranger force. In the summer of 1835, four volunteer ranger companies arrived at the fort to join with the fifth company. Captain Robert M. Coleman, who had strongly advocated creation of a tax-funded ranger force to protect settlers, led the men. The Rangers bought supplies from the Parkers and, after reorganizing, left the fort in August. The Rangers had a few Indian skirmishes, but the battalion was mustered out of service in mid-September. Had Rangers remained stationed at Fort Parker, what happened in the spring of 1836 might have been averted. On May 19, 1836, several hundred Comanche and Kiowa warriors attacked the fort. They killed five men, including family patriarch John Parker, father of Ranger proponent Daniel Parker. Five women and children were kidnapped, including little Cynthia Ann Parker. The others escaped. The reconstructed fort is off Farm to Market Road 1245 on State Park Road 35, north of Groesbeck. Initially a state park, the fort is now managed by the city of Groesbeck. A year to the day after the attack, former Ranger James Parker led an armed group to the abandoned fort and buried five sets of remains. Now known as Fort Parker Memorial Park, a large monument marks the mass grave. From Waco to San Antonio. For an overview of Ranger history, visit Waco's Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museum, 100 Texas Ranger Trail. First known as Fort Fisher, a short-lived ranger post established there in 1837, the museum opened in 1968 and has expanded since then. Sited on 32 acres on the south bank of the Brazos near downtown, the complex was later rebranded the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museum. In addition to exhibits telling the ranger story, two works of ranger-related public art stand outside the museum. A bronze of noted ranger and surveyor George B. Erath, and a larger-than-life bronze of an early-day horseback ranger bearing the Texas flag. Inside is a third piece, a life-size ranger statue, Old Ranger. Since its founding in 1839 as the capital of the Republic of Texas, Austin has been the headquarters for the Rangers. Construction began in 1853 on a limestone state house to replace the original frame capitol, which was in poor repair. There, in 1874, legislators created the Frontier Battalion of Rangers. For the first time in Texas history, the Rangers were vested with law enforcement authority. The Rangers were led by Major John B. Jones, a former Confederate officer who furthered the force's reputation as effective Indian fighters and prairie peace officers. Jones died in July 1881 and is buried in Austin's Oakwood Cemetery, 1601 Navasota Street. In November 1881, fire gutted the 28-year-old Capitol, and Ranger brass officed in a temporary state house until completion of the present red granite capitol in 1887. The Ranger headquarters remained there until the creation of the Texas Department of Public Safety in 1935, when the agency relocated to Camp Mabry on Austin's west side. The DPS remained headquartered at Camp Mabry, 35th and Mopac Boulevard, until a new complex opened in North Austin in 1953. The Texas Military Museum on post explores the long connection between the state's military and the Rangers. The Bullock Texas State History Museum, 1800 Congress Avenue, has three floors of permanent and changing exhibits. The museum's website, thestoryoftexas.com, includes a history of the Rangers. The Texas State Cemetery, 909 Navasota Street, final resting place of 30 Rangers and hundreds of other Lone Star notables, began with the death of one of those Rangers, Edward Burleson. In addition to his time as a Ranger or soldier, from 1841 to 1844, he had served as Vice President of the Republic of Texas. When he died in 1851, he was laid to rest on donated acreage in East Austin. That afforded Burleson one additional distinction. His was the first grave in a cemetery, now considered the Arlington of Texas. In 1910, the remains of Stephen F. Austin were relocated to the cemetery. In the heart of San Antonio stands the most historic structure in Texas, if not the entire Southwest, the Alamo. The old Spanish mission, overrun by the Mexican Army on March 6, 1836, is considered a shrine to liberty. While millions know the story, far fewer are aware that 32 Rangers died in the battle. The Daughters of the Republic of Texas maintained the Alamo until 2015, when the State General Land Office assumed control. The state has improved site interpretation, undertaken needed restoration, and recently opened the two-story, 24,000-square-foot Alamo Collection Center. That facility houses the extensive collection of Alamo artifacts assembled over the years by British rock star Phil Collins. Just across from the Alamo, German immigrant William Minger opened a two-story hotel in 1859. The Alamo City's finest hostelry throughout the 19th century, the Minger hosted presidents, generals, cattle kings, actors, famous writers, and other notables. Many Rangers and former Rangers spent time at the hotel, including Captain John S. Rip, rest in peace, Ford. Much expanded, the Minger, 204 Alamo Plaza, remains open today. In 1881, Albert Frederick opened the Buckhorn Saloon. Soon, accommodating customers short of funds, Frederick offered to trade drinks for trophy steer horns or deer antlers. Before long, the saloon's walls were covered with impressive mounts. The Buckhorn, 318 East Houston Street, remains in business. The former Texas Rangers Association maintains an 8,000-square-foot Ranger Museum there. The South Texas Heritage Center, 3801 Broadway Street, is a new addition to the nationally known Witte Museum. The center focuses on the diverse cultures that shaped South Texas, from the Comanches to the Spanish, Mexicans, Germans, and others, as well as cowboys and outlaws. In the 1830s, Rangers periodically camped under a stand of trees along a spring-fed stream running through what is now downtown Seguin. The large trees, still standing, southeast corner of Gonzales and Travis Streets, came to be known as the Ranger Oaks. Demonstrating they had business acumen as well as fighting skills, in 1838, Matthew Old Paint Caldwell and two other Rangers partnered to develop a town on land that included their former campsite. 33 men, mostly Rangers, bought shares in the venture. The new town was named for Texas hero and former Ranger Juan N. Seguin. The Seguin Guadalupe County Heritage Museum, 114 North River Street, tells this historic community's story. Seguin's grave lies beneath a flat granite tombstone at 789 South Saunders Street. A larger-than-life bronze statue depicting him astride a horse at the Battle of San Jacinto stands in the city's Central Park, bounded by Austin, Nolte, South River, and Donegan Streets. The best-known early-day Ranger was Captain Jack Hayes, a Tennessee-born surveyor credited with establishing the Ranger reputation. In 1847, Hayes got married in Seguin's two-story Magnolia Hotel. One of the city's oldest structures, the restored hostelry remains in business today. When news reached Gonzales in 1836 that the Alamo had fallen, General Sam Houston ordered the town burned. Escorted by the Texas Army, townspeople, including the grieving widows and children of the 32 Rangers who had volunteered to help defend the Alamo, fled eastward. A monument to the men of the Gonzales Ranging Company stands outside the Gonzales Memorial Museum, 414 Smith Street. A sculpted bronze plaque on the red granite cenotaph lists the names of those now known as the Immortal 32. In 1897, aging former Texas Ranger John S. Ripford, as a newspaper editor, Indian fighter, soldier, and politician, helped organize the Texas State Historical Association, as well as the forerunner of today's former Texas Rangers Association. Ranger Ring of Honor. More than a century later, the former Texas Rangers Foundation, the nonprofit arm of the FTRA, began raising funds to build a heritage center dedicated to Ranger history and the many Rangers who died in the line of duty over the last 200 years. In Fredericksburg, the first phase of the Texas Ranger Heritage Center, 1618 Main Street, opened in 2015. Sitting on 12 acres adjacent to old Fort Martin Scott, the first frontier fort established in Texas, the complex includes a 50-foot limestone campanile, a Ranger Ring of Honor built around a 20-ton, 5-point concrete range Ranger badge replica, 30 feet in diameter, an outdoor pavilion, an amphitheater, and a historical reenactment area. The Heritage Center's second phase will include a museum with interactive displays and a Ranger archive. A bronze statue of a Ranger leading a pack mule, originally placed in front of the old Pioneer Memorial Hall at San Antonio's Whitty Museum, was refurbished by the FTRA and moved to the Heritage Center by the pavilion. Also standing near the pavilion is a bronze of an 1850s Ranger holding a Sharps rifle. The Ranger Ring of Honor features plaques listing the names of all known Ranger line of duty deaths. Carved along the circumference of the badge are five Ranger defining traits: courage, determination, dedication, respect, and integrity. Longtime Texas writer Mike Cox, an elected member of the Texas Institute of Letters, has written 40 nonfiction books, including four volumes on Texas Ranger history. South Dakota. Discover adventure and cowboy history in the West River Cattle Country by Bill Markley. West River, South Dakota is cattle country. The Missouri River bisects the state from north to south. The eastern portion is called East River, and the western, the West River. Ancient glaciers forced the Missouri south along their western edges, while West River's streams and rivers, untouched by glaciers, continued cutting through the prairie from east to west. The Black Hills rise from the prairie to the west, while to the south, badlands stretch from west to east. Rolling prairie, rich in grama and wheatgrass, supported herds of bison, pronghorn, mule deer, and elk. Cheyenne and Lakota tribes inhabited the land, and after acquiring horses, metal spear points and arrowheads, as well as firearms, they flourished. The cattle industry got a late start in West River. The 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty established the Great Sioux Reservation, which included most of West River. In 1877, the federal government removed from the reservation the Black Hills and a 50-mile stretch of land along Dakota Territory's western border. By 1886, professional hunters had decimated the West River bison herds. In 1889, the federal government diminished, then broke up, the Great Sioux Reservation into five smaller reservations, as Dakota Territory became the states of North and South Dakota. Much of the West River became public domain, open range. Through its treaty with the Lakota tribes, the federal government promised to provide them beef. Herders drove cattle from the east to the Lakota agencies, Standing Rock and Cheyenne River, along the Missouri River, and after agencies were established at Rosebud and Pine Ridge and along South Dakota's southern border, Nebraska and Texas cattlemen drove herds to those agencies. By 1878, West River cattle herds were thriving on the open range of the Belle Fourche area north of the Black Hills. The government had not opened the range for homesteading, so anyone could use it. In 1880, cattlemen formed the Black Hills Livestock Association, and by the winter of 1881-82, the 60 members of the association had an estimated 264,000 herd of cattle. At first, most of the animals were Texas Longhorns, later replaced by Herefords and Shorthorns, and many cowboys were from Texas. Cattle outfits increased and expanded throughout the open range. There were no fences, and cattle tended to drift, especially during the winter. The cattlemen needed to recover their cattle, brand the calves, and castrate the males. The livestock associations organized roundups in the spring and fall. The range was divided into districts. A cattleman was designated as a district foreman, and each outfit sent a cowboy, called a rep, to take charge of any cattle belonging to the outfit. The reps worked together cooperatively under the direction of the foreman. They rode over a wide area, bringing back all cattle they found to a central location where they separated the animals into the owner's herds. Calves were branded with the brands their mothers carried, and male calves were castrated. The cowboys then herded the cattle back to their home ranges. Fall roundups were held to separate out animals destined to be trailed to shipping locations. Working cattle could be a dangerous business. The cowboys needed to be alert for whatever nature might throw their way. George Gunn recalled a 1902 spring roundup where they were trailing a herd of 1,000 head along a ridge north of the White River. George wrote, "Ray Keeler and I stayed behind the herd to haze up the drags or stragglers. All of a sudden, like a bolt out of the blue, we were struck from the northwest with one of the worst wind, hail, and lightning storms ever known in that part of the country. As the herd turned tail to flee from the storm, naturally, Ray and I were in the thick of the rushing cattle, rapidly making down the slope. When our mounts turned with heads down in the storm, our single rig saddles flew up behind, and we were unloaded out front. Ray's horse ran off, but George was able to catch his. When the storm hit, the four horses, pulling the mess wagon, jackknifed and the wagon rolled to the bottom of the canyon, scattering all contents along the way. Fortunately, no one in our outfit was hurt. Several were left hatless and horseless. We tried to make a temporary camp and spent the rest of the dark night in our wet beds." In the early 1900s, railroads were built across the West River, bringing homesteaders and ending the open range. Many homesteaders couldn't make a go of it and left. Land was consolidated into larger holdings. So today, there are cattle ranches, large and small. You can still find vistas of vast grasslands as the old-time cowboys would have seen. Here are some suggestions for your West River tour. Mobridge. The railroads established shipping points along the Missouri River. Cowboys drove West River cattle to the river, where they were either ferried or swam across and then loaded onto eastbound trains. Located on the Missouri's east bank, Mobridge was one of these destinations. The town's name was a contraction of Missouri River Bridge, future site of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway Bridge. The completion of the bridge in March 1908 doomed Evarts, Lebeau, and other downriver shipping points. One of Mobridge's major events is the Sitting Bull Stampede Rodeo, held every 4th of July, along with a parade and carnival. Fort Pierre. Fort Pierre, on the Missouri's west bank, began as a trading post in 1817. The Vereen Dry Museum houses vintage saddles, cowboy hats and trappings, guns, and more. The Casey Tibbs South Dakota Rodeo Center features Casey's memorabilia of 9 world champion rodeo events, as well as those of trick rider Matty Goff Newcomb and other South Dakota rodeo champions. For over 90 years, Fort Pierre has held a 4th of July rodeo with all the traditional events: bull riding, calf roping, barrel racing, and saddle bronc riding. North of town is Scotty Phillip Cemetery, where Scotty Phillip is buried. Phillip, a West River cattleman, acquired buffalo from Fred Dupree and others to save the buffalo, earning his nickname the Buffalo King. To the south is the 116,000-acre Fort Pierre National Grasslands, one of three in South Dakota, where cattle graze and wildlife abound. Bring your horse and ride the prairie. You can camp, but there are no campsite facilities. Interstate 90 stops. Driving Interstate 90 from east to west, and after crossing the Missouri River, visit Oklahoma. Stop at Al's Oasis for a buffalo burger. Further west, stop at Murdo and visit the Pioneer Auto Museum. It has not only an extensive vintage car collection, but many Old West items. The next must stop is the 1880 town, a collection of buildings and antiques gathered from all over West River. There are plenty of cowboy and ranching items to hold your attention. Any West River trip must include a stop at Wall Drug. It's more than a drugstore. Items range from inexpensive souvenirs to high-quality Western boots, hats, clothing, and gear. Wall Drug has one of the best Western bookstores in the country. Rapid City. Rapid City, at the edge of the Black Hills, is West River's largest city and location of the South Dakota Stock Growers Association, which has represented livestock producers since 1892. Every January, Rapid City hosts the Black Hills Stock Show and Rodeo. The eight-day extravaganza includes 10 breeds of cattle sales, a two-day horse sale, livestock seminars, country western entertainment, over 300 vendors, and more. Visit the Journey Museum's Pioneer exhibits. 6 miles south is Fort Hays. Enjoy good food and entertainment at the Chuck Wagon Supper and Music Show. Stroll around the Western-themed grounds that includes buildings from the Dances with Wolves Fort Hays set. Custer State Park. Custer State Park, in the southern Black Hills, is home to 1,400 head of buffalo descended from Scotty Phillips' herd. View the herd and other animals on the park's wildlife loop and attend the Buffalo Roundup and Arts Festival held each autumn. Deadwood. Deadwood is associated with mining, saloons, and gambling. However, it has a cowboy element. Since 1924, Deadwood has held the Days of 76 Rodeo and Parade each July. The Days of 76 Museum exhibits past rodeo and parade items, including one of South Dakota's largest collection of wagons, carriages, and stagecoaches, and it has an extensive firearms collection. Belforch. Belforch is where South Dakota's story with cattle began. When the railroad reached town in 1890, cattle were rapidly shipped out, and it became one of the world's largest cattle shipping points. It is still an important railhead today. For over 100 years, Belforch has held the five-day Black Hills Roundtop and Rodeo around the 4th of July. It includes a carnival, a mile-long parade, the Miss Rodeo South Dakota contest, and fireworks. The Tri-State Museum has exhibits on ranching and the Roundup and Rodeo. Lemon. If you want a small-town experience, drive to Lemon near the North Dakota border. The town was named after the renowned open-range cowboy turned cattleman Ed Lemon. View local artist John Lopez's western-themed sculptures, including Boss Cowman, tour the world's largest petrified wood park, and examine pioneer ranching items in the Grand River Museum. Looking for wide-open, desolate country? Top off your gas tank, load up your cooler, and drive to the back roads of northwestern South Dakota's Harding County. According to Beef 2 Live's website, South Dakota has the most cattle per person in the United States, 3,650,000 cattle to 844,877 humans. When in West River, leave the main highway and you'll be in cattle country.
Hi. This is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine.
Echo Lodge to catch up with East Africa's nomad herders, the Maasai. A one-time Texan small rancher expands a common thread connecting history's grazers. By Rick Bass. I live in Montana, where, though certainly we have cattle, we have even more land, more grass than cows. Other than our 9 months of winter, this is heaven for grazing animals. Once, and not too long ago, there were buffalo all up and down the Rocky Mountain front, the sea of grass that blew in waves in the wind coming down that great wall of stone. The buffalo moved like wind, so much so that native cultures spoke of fire and buffalo as similar forces. As a child growing up in Texas, I lamented often that I was only able to see those herds in my mind. I wondered what it might be like to see Africa, one of the few other places on earth where the perfect combination of vast space, steady sunlight, and the clockwork of the seasons, monsoons breaking open the cracked heart of drought every year just in time, conspired to yield, produce such a near infinitude of the living. And back then, even more than today, Texas was cattle culture. Anyone who had any land at all had a few cattle. My best friend Kirby and I even tried our hand at it, simply because it was the fabric of the culture all around us. Kirby's grandfather had a farm near Brenham in the soft rolling hills northwest of Houston that had some grass on it, so we bought a few calves, auction rejects, and tried to fatten them up. More on that later. In the meantime, for Africa, I waited. Life is long, and I thought I would go someday. I went to college in Utah, where dairy cattle stippled the valley bottoms beneath high mountains. I moved to Mississippi, where shiny black Angus stood glinting like coal back in the dappled shade, hiding from the heat. I moved to Montana, where the buffalo were gone, but where there were still deer, elk, antelope, everything else but buffalo. Bird hunting with my dogs, I wandered past the stone circles of teepee rings, some so recent, 150, 200 years ago, that they had not even been covered by the creep of soil whooshing down from the mountains just above me. Suddenly, 60 years had gone past in my own life. I had lived long enough to see sufficient changes to the world and the land to qualify as at least a thin kind of history. And I realized if I was going to go see the animals of Africa, it was time. I wanted to go to Kenya for the diversity as well as numbers, and a friend of a friend recommended a lodge, Il Nwesi, to the northern half of the East African nation in the Liwa Conservation District. On the phone, it sounded too good to be true. It was not. And the website, of course, was vibrant, teeming with images of zebras splashing through rivers, elephants lumbering in long lines through shaded river bottoms, and the dazzling languor of sunstruck cheetahs, regal, watching over endless sere grasslands, their charcoal faces like masks, searching for whatever to run down next. Il Nwesi works in partnership with a nonprofit, Wild Philanthropy, that seeks to find solutions in Africa to conservation needs and challenges. The animals were all present in the Liwa Wildlife Conservancy, a region dedicated to preserving their habitat. But what interested me in Il Nwesi just as much was the way the indigenous people, the Maasai, were central to the lodge and in charge of running it. Will Jones, director of Wild Philanthropy, told me that although there are many tourism-slash-wildlife-viewing-slash-safari lodges in northern Kenya, all the others are run by non-African managers, and that Il Nwesi is the only lodge where the Maasai are not only the employees, but the owners. There are a lot of eco-friendly lodges throughout Kenya, but this commitment to local people seems important to me, and I was interested to see the character and quality of the operation, as well as the character and quality of the land. The Maasai, traditionally a hunter-gatherer culture, developed into a nomadic herding society renowned for their expertise in taking care of meat on the hoof, goats, and cattle in the red rock deserts and mountains of their homeland. So wedded have the Maasai become to the culture of cattle that there is a belief among the Maasai that every cow in the world belongs to the Maasai. And this is where the small rancher past of my Texas childhood, in the lush, forgiving, productive landscape of East Texas and the Gulf Coast, felt, in Kenya, so far away. I recognized a little of it, the way a single cattle herder, walking along behind five or six lean cows, tapping them with a stick to keep them directed and moving, reminded me of small farms and ranches of my youth, where folks had half a dozen cattle or even a dozen on 40 acres. But here, the Maasai had all the land to the horizon. It was just damned hard land, mythically hard. How can a cow put on a pound of flesh amid such stone? By walking, working, trying to find a spot of grass here, a spot there, some shade here or some water there, while beyond, upon the ridges in the protected area, the real wildlife, what was here before cattle, is protected and waits for tourists to come see it, with those revenues feeding the Maasai and allowing them a bit of cushion, enabling them to keep driving their cattle here and there, tapping them forward into each next day. The barbed wire fences that had helped enforce the current U.S. cattle culture were not present at Illinoisi. There's one big fence which the Maasai used to keep cattle out of a central core of their wildlife conservancy. They need the wildlife and they need the cattle. It's a simple and elegant solution. They protect the best grass for the wildlife, the real cash cows of their hardscrabble economy, while keeping the past alive, the nomadic cattle herds. Keeping the cattle moving helps the land recover. A foot in the past, a foot in the future. It's this way everywhere, is it not? Texas, Kenya, Timbuktu, Peoria. There are, of course, pressures on the system. A rhino, or rather the horn of an individual rhino, is by the curious and mad reckoning of our own peculiar troubled species worth, say, 10,000 cattle. 10,000 cattle or one rhino horn. Are you kidding me? So the Maasai employs game guards to help protect the community investment. Young men who walk all day at some quiet and often undetected distance behind the rhinos and elephants and giraffes, not with the atlatl or spear of but two or three generations ago, but with machine guns, Kalashnikovs and Chinese-made Kalashnikov knockoffs, sun-varnished from whatever last war they'd been used in, sometimes manufactured in the very same countries that seek simultaneously to devour the horn of the rhino that the guns would protect, or conversely, kill. History. We are living on its edge in every step. Perhaps there are moments when its movement is a slow or even merry rippling current, and we ride it like upturned leaves, barely noticing all that is going past. But perhaps, too, there are times when it is titanic, when waves tower, when ice shelves fall from the edges of the continents, times when the continents themselves get up and begin walking. It can take a long time to go back into the past. The gravel airstrip in Liwa, in northern Kenya's Laikipia, is a start, as is a two-hour cobblestone land cruiser ride to the lodge. David Jeeps, the Maasai guide who picks us up, tells us about two white rhinos they guard at the lodge for tourists to see in an enclosure of about 15 acres, keeping them forever safe, yet no longer able to roam the world free. These two rhinos, gifts from South Africa, are new, he says, brother and sister. They won't mate. getting used to their new country. Jeeps says the community is still grieving the loss of the previous rhino. It too was a gift. One of the Maasai's young men went to Liwa to pick it up when it was just a baby, blind and orphaned, and walked it 40 miles home to the village like a dog, sleeping with it for warmth in the cold desert nights. The stars above delineated its new home, no matter that they were unseen by the little rhino. The baby imprinted on people. They were able to keep it safe for only a couple of years before poachers got it. He was such a sweet rhino, Jeeps says. How improbable is this world, to dream, to attempt, to guard a $50,000 horn out in the middle of what feels like one of the remotest places on earth, with but a gun or two and a single ranger. Everywhere around us, stone and scrub, no water. Dazzling blue sky. The blackest night pierced by what seem like millions of diamonds. It looks like my beloved Texas Hill Country, Fredericksburg, Austin, Johnson City, Llano, without the people. The Lodge, a masterwork of elegance and simplicity. Small world. There's a sign thanking the late fashion designer Liz Claiborne and her husband Art Ortenberg for their conservation efforts in the region. Claiborne and Ortenberg helped conservation in the Little Valley in northwestern Montana, the Yaak Valley, where I live, too. Small world. Their eye was drawn to beauty and to wildness. They're both gone now. They worked hard at this kind of thing all their lives. I get out of the Jeep. Thatched roofs, tile floors, and $10 million or $100 million view. The curve of the earth on one side, a canyon with a river on the other side. The animals are at the river. No number, no valuation can be put on a river in the desert. Such is the character of miracles. Such, too, is the character of the most basic and mundane things, things we take for granted. An elephant, a glass of water, one more moment of life. At Il Nuesi, our lodging is a thatched roof treehouse. One walks down through a cool garden to a swinging rope bridge and into the adobe open-walled quarters, an immense mosquito-netted bed looks out over the river below. In the morning, we walk into the desert with jeeps, weaving our way through brush and sand and stone. Giraffes, warthogs, elephants, and zebras flow before us in waves. Was Texas ever like this? And if so, what happened? We know what happened. It is up to the Maasai, really, not Western conservationists, to hold on to what they still have. And with the rules of the world changing so fast now. That night, we drive down to the Maasai village to visit and take a meal. The village has slaughtered a goat and offered to make it available to us. The children and young people are dancing the way they do every evening, the curious and mesmerizing chant and hop, each trying to leap higher than all the others. Red robes, red as the desert, red from the goat's blood, red meat cooking over the red coals as red dusk settles over us, then night. The Maasai continue to drive and herd their cattle and goats to places where they can find the thin grass and increasingly rare water. Giant acacia trees with their rich bounty of shade ring their village. The entire perimeter is protected by a fence woven of thorn bushes, impenetrable to lion and leopard, protecting the Maasai as well as their stock, which, at this time of year, consists of baby goats, cute as the dickens, galloping around in little corrals of woven branches, buzz tails spinning, meat everywhere. About those cattle that Kirby and I tried to raise in the soft green rolling hills outside of Brenham. We bought the calves cheap at auctions, defective animals that no one else wanted, $35 per calf, and turned them loose on Kirby's grandfather's farm, The barbed wire fence was sagging and rotting, and the little calves slipped through it at will, escaped into the ether, into what back then was the future but is now the past. No matter how hard we tried to patch the old fence, we never could hold them for more than a few days. We were not any kind of cowboys, nor certainly were we any kind of Indians or any other indigenous people. We were just kind of in the middle, and I marvel at the tight latticework of wreathing of the thorned fences of the Maasai in Kenya, where people's lives and livelihoods depend upon the quality of their work. The culture of meat is the same. We sit around the campfire with our plates of goat. We look up at the stars. We hope for rain. We know we look up at the stars and know that we do not know, can never know, what will be coming the next day, but that we are here in the moment, each doing our work, our best, and that in the mornings we will get up and go out into the world and seek to keep doing our best, and that we might be called upon to adapt. Some things, Maasai and cattle, change slowly, even as all the rest of the world and its changes rotates around us, constellations in motion around a pivot we sometimes cannot see, but keep following, leaning forward.
Where to go in this magical mountain mecca? Our Santa Fe Insider steers you to the classic, the cool, the new, and the unique by Wolf Schneider. It's a great time to be in Santa Fe. It's the year of Indigenous Celebration New Mexico, 2022, a big citywide celebration of the 100 years of India Market, 100th Gallup Intertribal Ceremonial, 85th anniversary of the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, and 60th anniversary of Institute of American Indian Arts. It's such a big deal, it's got its own website, IndigenousCelebration22.org. But it doesn't take a mega celebration to make travel to the city different, super special. Here are just some of the memorable experiences that make Santa Fe one of our favorite places in the West. 21 Super Santa Fe Experiences. 1. Immerse in the market. Santa Fe in August is all about Indian market. This year, market is August 20 to 21, with lots of events swirling around those dates. Some of the highlights: making history, celebrating 60 years of the Institute of American Indian Arts and 50 years of the IAIA Museum of Contemporary Native Arts anniversary dinner and auction for scholarships at La Fonda on August 17th. Southwestern Association of Indian Arts Best of Show ceremony and luncheon on August 19th. The SWAIA 100th Anniversary Gala on August 20th. And the SWAIA Indigenous Fashion Show on August 21. 2. Go to the Artist's Way. Any time in Santa Fe is art intensive, but during Indian Market, everything amps up. The gallery-oriented satellite art fair, Art Indigenous Santa Fe, modeled after Art Basel, takes place at El Museo de Cultura on August 18 to 21. Participating galleries include Blue Rain Gallery, Chiaroscuro Contemporary Art, and LA's Trota Bono Contemporary. Blue Rain Gallery mounts a Native American group exhibition on August 18 to 22, with a reception on August 18 from 5 to 8 p.m. A solo show for Preston Singletary follows August 19 to September 3, with a reception on August 19 from 5 to 8 p.m. Manito Gallery holds three shows: Palace Jewelers, its annual Native Jewelry Trunk Show on August 18 and 19 from 5 to 8 p.m., J.D. Challenger in person on August 18 from 5 to 8 p.m., and Overland Joe on August 19 from 5 to 8 p.m. Sorrel Sky Gallery features Ray Tracy, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, and Kevin Redstar on August 19th, reception from 5 to 7:30, and continuing through August 21. King Galleries presents Legacies, a group show of native artists, including Tammy Garcia and Autumn Bortz Medlock, on August 19th, 3 to 5 p.m. Chiaroscuro Contemporary Art holds an Indian Market group exhibition and solo show for Emmy Whitehorse. 3. Quaff a Classic Cocktail. The Bell Tower Bar at La Fonda on the Plaza offers great drinks and great views of Indian Market and all of the plaza. 4. Get Interactive. See for yourself why the unforgettable art installation Meow Wolf was just named number 3 in the live events category for Fast Company's list of the world's most innovative companies. 5. Hit the Trails. The City Different Hit loves its trails. There's the Margarita Trail, the Green Chili Cheeseburger Trail, and of course, there are actual amazing hiking trails. If you do all 3, just make sure the margs come last. 6. Have Christmas year-round. Christmas is what you say if you want both red and green sauce on your New Mex food. That's how we love it. But then we totally love Christmas. Speaking of, if you happen to be in Santa Fe during Christmas season, it's extra enchanting bathed in the light of the ubiquitous luminaria. 7. Soak it off. Get in hot water and relax your cares away at the 10,000 Waves, a Japanese-inspired spa, or Oho Santa Fe Spa and Resort. If massages and treatments are your relaxation-slash-wellness jam, Santa Fe obliges with many other top-drawer spas. 8. Take a tour. Walk, eat, photograph. This city has tours for every taste, including the Savor Santa Fe Food Tour, David Hopman's two-hour photo tour and class, 4x4 mountain adventures, and Alan Hauser sculpture garden tours. 9. See the Miraculous Staircase, a former Roman Catholic church that's now a museum. Loretta Chapel is home of the famed helix-shaped spiral staircase that the Sisters of Loretto believe was built by St. Joseph. 10. Go gallery hopping. Take a pleasant stroll along Canyon Road, a lovely landscaped arts district of more than 100 galleries and boutiques. 11. Meander among the museums. Museum Hills boasts the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, the Museum of International Folk Art, the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, and the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art, and Museum Hill Cafe, where the views from the outside patio are as gorgeous as the art in the museums. Back on the plaza downtown, make time for the exhibition Honoring Tradition and Innovation, 100 Years of Santa Fe's Indian Market, 1922 to 2022, which runs August 7th through August 31st, 2023, at the New Mexico History Museum. 12. Be Botanical. Art at Museum Hill, stop and smell the pinyon at the Santa Fe Botanical Gardens, where you can explore orchards with perennial borders, roses and lavender, meadow and xeric garden, raised beds for annual crops, and an extensive collection of plants with traditional uses, natural areas showcasing native plants common to the community, and from July 28th through August 14th, Shakespeare in the Garden, presenting The Comedy of Errors. 13. Peruse the Plaza. Yes, it has 4 sides, but it's the entire north side of Santa Fe's Northtown Plaza that's of special interest. There, you'll find the Palace of the Governors, built in 1610, and the oldest continually occupied public building in the country, now housing the New Mexico History Museum. But it's what's under the shaded adobe facade that draws the most visitors and shoppers. In this portal, you'll find a rotating selection of artisans from various pueblos throughout New Mexico selling their authentic creations as vetted participants in the Native American Artisans Portal Program. About the only time you won't find them there is when the space is taken up by Indian Market. 14. Check out the church. The Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi really is the cathedral different. You can't miss it. Not only is it the most visible thing in town, it's also oddly unfinished, missing two originally intended spires above the bell towers. 15. Contemplate O'Keeffe. If you can't make it out to her former home and studio in Albuquerque, Georgia's namesake museum in Santa Fe spans the 6 decades of O'Keeffe's artistic career with rotating exhibitions of its collection. 16. Live history. El Rancho de las Golondrinas, 200-acre living history museum, represents various time periods in New Mexico. 17. Make tracks to the rail yard. The 50-acre Rail Yard Arts District offers shopping, dining, contemporary art, entertainment, green space, pedestrian promenade, and the all-important super fresh Santa Fe Farmers Market. 18. Be with the birds. On the 135 acres of the Randall Davy Audubon Center and Sanctuary, you'll encounter striking landscapes, wildlife, hiking trails, guided bird walks, and tours of the home and studio of American painter and art educator Randall Davy, known for his portraits and equine paintings. 19. Take a break in Tusuki. Founded in 1740, the Spanish village of Tusuki sits just north of Santa Fe, a few miles south of the current Pueblo. Today, some rich and famous call the otherwise unassuming village home. Eat at the iconic El Nido and or the long-standing casual neighborhood hang Tusuki Market and hope for an Ollie McGraw sighting. 20. Day trip to Taos. The scenic byway to Taos goes both high and low. The high road winds through the Santa de Cristo Mountains, and the low road winds along the Rio Grande. In the fall, the aspens are changing. Sublime. 21. Shop, relax, repeat. This town has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to great shopping for everything from turquoise and textiles to boots and buckles. Some of our favorite stops include Samsville Gallery, Rocky Gorman, Maloof on the Plaza, Sunwest on the Plaza, Sorrel Sky Gallery, Maya Gallery, Suzani, Nathalie, Rockbuster, Santa Fe Gold Works, and Barbara Michael Fine Art.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.